From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, European Union leaders pledged to triple funding for a search and rescue operation for migrants in the Mediterranean. The NATO chief reports a substantial Russian buildup of military hardware near the Ukraine border. And another U.S. city, this time Baltimore, is the scene of protest after a police suspect dies.
It's sad that we had to take this step to get this type of publicity from the outside when we've been calling for this for years.
It is all ahead. I'm Ira Melman. Welcome. During an emergency summit in Brussels, European Union leaders have pledged to triple funding for a search and rescue operation for migrants in the Mediterranean Sea and crack down on traffickers. Lisa Bryan has more on the meeting aimed at helping solve a growing humanitarian crisis.
The European leaders agreed to a four-point plan to tackle the Mediterranean migration crisis, including capturing and destroying smugglers' boats and sharply increasing funding for the Mediterranean search and rescue mission known as Triton. At a news conference after Thursday's summit, President of the European Council, Donald Tusk of Poland, which holds the rotating European Union presidency, said Europe did not cause a tragedy that has seen hundreds of illegal immigrants die at sea this year.
But that doesn't mean we can be indifferent. We are facing a difficult summer and we need to be ready to act.
Tusk said EU leaders also agreed to curb illegal immigration, protect refugees, and encourage relocation of migrants from so-called frontline countries like Italy to other EU countries on a voluntary basis. The EU has been sharply criticized for not doing enough to address the Mediterranean migration crisis. Even before the summit ended, the rights group Amnesty International criticized the measures being discussed as woefully inadequate. Even European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker expressed disappointment with the result.
J'aurais voulu que d'ores et déjà nous soyons plus ambitieux.
Juncker said he had hoped the outcome would be more ambitious, but he said it allows for more reflection in the coming weeks. The summit was called after hundreds of people drowned in the Mediterranean on Sunday when their boat capsized. Before the summit, top United Nations and other migration officials called on the EU to go beyond what they called a minimalist approach toward illegal migration. Experts say broader issues like poverty and conflict in migrants' home countries must also be addressed. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg is reporting a substantial Russian buildup of military hardware near the Ukraine border. That includes more than 1,000 pieces of heavy equipment, advanced weapon systems, tanks, and artillery, he says. Speaking Thursday in Brussels, Stoltenberg also accused the Kremlin of providing pro-Russian separatists inside eastern Ukraine with advanced training, despite a ceasefire brokered 2 months ago by Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France. Stoltenberg said the buildup gives reason for great concern and would allow separatists to launch new military offensive with little advanced warning. In Moscow, Russia's defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, denied the NATO claims while accusing the U.S. military of providing training and urban fighting to Ukrainian National Guardsmen near the Russian border. The U.S. State Department spokeswoman, Marie Harf, rejected Shoigu's accusation, at one point calling it ridiculous. She said all U.S. military training activity in Ukraine is taking place in the country's west near the Polish border. Armenia's president, Serge Sargsyan, has thanked the world leaders who attended a memorial service for the victims of a mass killing of Armenians by Ottoman Turks 100 years ago. Speaking at the site of Armenia's permanent memorial to the victims slaughtered during World War I, Mr. Sargsyan said the presence of such leaders as the presidents of France, Russia, Serbia, and the Greek-ruled part of Cyprus confirmed their commitment to human values by saying nothing is forgotten. Turkey denies killings of Armenians by Ottoman Turks was a genocide, as charged by some. It says the Armenians died during fighting in a civil war in which they were aided by the Russians. It says the number of deaths is far fewer than the 1.5 million claimed. Turkey formally protests against any government that calls the killings a genocide. It recalled its representative to the Vatican earlier this month after Pope Francis called the Armenian massacre the first genocide of the 20th century. U.S. President Obama released a statement Thursday in which he commemorated the killings, calling them a massacre, a terrible carnage, and horrific violence, but he did not use the word genocide. In a climate of greater tolerance, growing numbers of people in Turkey are discovering their grandmothers were Armenians. Hundreds of thousands of Armenians during the mass deportations and slaughter in the early 1900s escaped by forced conversion to Islam, where Armenian children were taken by Turkish families and assimilated into their families. Now their stories are increasingly being heard. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul that the revelations are viewed as an important step.
It was Fethiye Çetin's book, My Grandmother, that opened the door to one of the darkest chapters in Turkish history. The book documents her grandmother's hidden life as an Armenian orphan that she only revealed to Çetin when she was 70.
Armeni bir ailenin çocuğu olarak.
She experienced the genocide as the child of an Armenian family, that she made the long walk of death and arrived in the Sirmik town of Diyarbakir. And there she was taken as an adopted daughter by a Muslim family. She kept all the details in her memory alive. Her silence really touched me. I wanted to break this silence and share the truth I learned.
Historians estimate that up to 200,000 Armenians, mainly children and some young women, survived the deportations and mass killings of 1915 and were assimilated into Muslim families. The 2004 publication of Çetin's book, which became a bestseller, helped many people acknowledge their Armenian roots. The office of Argos, a bilingual Turkish-Armenian newspaper, is one of the first places many people come looking for help in trying to discover the full story of their Armenian past. The paper publishes all inquiries about searches for relatives.
Every week, a couple of people come here to ask for help in this matter.
It was a reaction to the murder of Argos founder Harun Dink by a Turkish nationalist in 2007 that gave further impetus to people seeking to uncover their past.
10,000 people started walking from Taksim Square to the Agos newspaper shouting, "We are all Harun Dink and we are all Armenian." This was a slogan for solidarity. We all knew that not all the people walking there were Armenians. Nobody was aware of it at the time, but this created a break in the political climate in Turkey.
Dink's funeral was one of the largest in Turkey's history. Documentaries are now being made of the lives of the Armenian orphans, contributing to the opening up of the debate. Çetin says the growing numbers of Armenian orphan stories coincides with important changes in Turkish society.
The society is very different. It is more dynamic, more inquisitive. That's why I think the society is starting to change.
With Çetin's grandmother's story continuing to be the inspiration for more families to uncover their stories of hidden Armenian ancestors, the hope is that legacy can offer a path for Turkey and its people to reconcile themselves with their history. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Italy wants more information from the United States about how an Italian aid worker was killed in a U.S. drone strike on the Afghan-Pakistan border as officials sought to explain why it took 3 months to be told about what they call the tragic error. Foreign Minister Paolo Gentiloni told Parliament in a hastily scheduled briefing that in an inaccessible war zone where hostage-taking is frequent, it took that long for U.S. intelligence to verify Giovanni Laporto had been killed. President Barack Obama Thursday announced the deaths of Laporto and American hostage Warren Weinstein during a mid-January airstrike on a suspected al-Qaeda target. The U.S. president has offered his deepest apologies for the deaths. VOA correspondent Aru Pandey has more from the White House.
In his brief emotional statement, President Obama said he cannot imagine the anguish of the families of American Warren Weinstein and Italian Giovanni Laporto, and could only offer these words.
As president and as commander-in-chief, I take full responsibility for all our counterterrorism operations, including the one that inadvertently took the lives of Warren and Giovanni. I profoundly regret what happened. On behalf of the United States government, I offer our deepest apologies to the families.
USAID contractor Warren Weinstein was kidnapped by Al-Qaeda gunmen from the Pakistani city of Lahore in 2011. His life ended less than 4 years later in January when a purported U.S. drone strike hit a compound in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region.
We believed that this was an Al-Qaeda compound, that no civilians were present, and that capturing these terrorists was not possible. And we do believe that the operation did take out dangerous members of Al-Qaeda. What we did not know, tragically, is that Al-Qaeda was hiding the presence of Warren and Giovanni in this same compound.
President Obama said as soon as the cause of Weinstein and Laporto's deaths was determined, he ordered the operation be declassified and publicly disclosed, noting the hostages' families deserve to know the truth. He directed a full review and said the United States will do its utmost to ensure such a tragedy will not be repeated. Arup Pandey, VOA News at the White House.
Indonesia has asked foreign embassies to send representatives to a maximum security prison on the island of Nusa Kambangan this weekend to visit prisoners awaiting execution for drug trafficking convictions. It's not known when the nine foreign prisoners and one Indonesian will stand before firing squads, but Jakarta has not yet given the 72-hour notice for the executions as is required by law there. Among the drug offenders are nationals from Australia, Brazil, France, and Nigeria. Indonesia's hardline stance on its mandatory death penalty for drug trafficking has strained relations with all of those countries. President Joko Widodo, who took office in October, has been a strong supporter of executing drug offenders, saying the country is facing a narcotics emergency. In January, the country executed six people convicted of drug trafficking. At the sixth anniversary of the Asian-African Conference in Indonesia, leaders strongly defended principles of self-determination against modern-day imperialism, but they barely mentioned democracy and human rights. VOA's Brian Padden reports on the commemoration of the gathering in Bandung, Indonesia, that first brought together leaders from many newly independent nations to discuss collective peace, security, and economic issues.
Indonesian President Joko Widodo walked side by side with Chinese President Xi Jinping down Bandung's main street Friday. The leaders of Swaziland, Madagascar, Sierra Leone, East Timor, and Zimbabwe also joined in the ceremonial procession to commemorate the 1955 Asian-African Conference that gave a united voice to many countries that had recently gained independence from Western colonial powers. Also in the front of the procession was former Indonesian President Megawati Sukarno-Putri, head of President Widodo's political party, and daughter of the late President Sukarno, who organized the 1955 conference. At a ceremony at the Merdeka Building Museum where the first conference took place, President Widodo called on leaders from developing nations to renew their commitment to the Bandung principles established 60 years ago.
Mari kita gelorakan kembali semangat Bandung.
He said, let us reinvigorate our Bandung struggle. Let's continue the struggle of our predecessors 60 years ago. We have to increase our tolerance and work towards world peace. The 10 Bandung principles that emerged from the first conference defended a nation's right of self-determination, opposed outside interference in the internal affairs of a sovereign state, and promoted human rights and the peaceful reconciliation of disputes. Leaders from Zimbabwe, Myanmar, Egypt, and Venezuela also spoke. They were selected to represent different regions of the world, but they have also all faced international sanctions for repressing democratic opposition and other dissenting voices in their own countries. Robert Mugabe, the 91-year-old president of Zimbabwe, lashed out at the U.S. and Western countries that he says still violate the sovereignty of many nations through force and financial sanctions.
Many among us here present can attest to the incessant assaults on our country's sovereignty, and on our national economies by the godfathers of the regime change agenda.
Both the United States and the European Union this year renewed sanctions against top leaders of Zimbabwe's government. Sanctions were imposed in 2002 over electoral fraud and human rights abuses. Jorge Arreaza, the vice president of Venezuela, which this year faced new U.S. sanctions over human rights violations and its treatment of the political opposition, said U.S. imperialism must be opposed.
Hoy el desafío es mucho mayor. Es más difuso. Se trata de no estar alineados.
He says today the challenge is aligning the disenfranchised in facing injustice, in fighting the disrespect of sovereignty, and in combating neocolonialism. Other leaders addressed the major themes of the conference. Egypt's Prime Minister Ibrahim Malib spoke out in favor of Palestinian independence. Myanmar's President Thein Sein focused on economic development through increased cooperation. Brian Patton, VOA News, Jakarta.
From Washington, this is International Edition from the Voice of America. Hundreds of protesters gathered in downtown Baltimore in the eastern U.S. state of Maryland Thursday to again demand changes to the justice system following the death of a 25-year-old man taken into police custody last week. Officials arrested two people for disorderly conduct in what was otherwise a loud but peaceful protest as that city awaits more information from authorities about how Freddie Gray died. VOA's Victoria Maki has more from the rally.
In this Baltimore neighborhood, Freddie Gray knelt under the eyes of police early on Sunday morning, April 12th. In quick succession, Gray made eye contact with a police officer, ran away, was caught with a switchblade on his hip, and was dragged into a police van. At a downtown hospital a week later, he died from what a family attorney says was a nearly severed spinal cord. The Baltimore Police Department says it will release information on its investigation of the incident late next week. Gray's death follows a string of high-profile police-involved killings that have raised allegations of civil rights abuses around the country.
This is the reason why we run, because we already know it's a 90% chance that if you don't run, you're going to get locked up for something.
You're going to get locked up or you're going to get hurt.
It's sad that we had to take this death to get this type of publicity from the outside when we've been calling for this for years.
Melissa also lives in the neighborhood and shares Sean's distrust of police.
They have been given badges to be bullies.
That's right.
They've been given badges to terrorize.
Baltimore residents have held several rallies since Gray's death, and they plan to protest again later this week.
And we want to resign for office today.
For one man, that means being the only one on a windswept afternoon shouting for justice in front of the police department. Victoria Mackey, VOA News, Baltimore.
Several high-profile police shooting deaths across the United States in recent months have stoked public outrage against law enforcement. We hear more from Chicago at VOA's Kane Farabaugh.
Protester Todd St. Hill is outraged over the acquittal of an off-duty Chicago police detective charged in the shooting death of 22-year-old Rakia Boyd.
I think people are dealing with a lot of hurt.
Over 300 dead!
St. Hill says the incident is another example of the racial tension that exists between police and the people they serve and protect.
Police react to black people in this country in a violent way. They always have.
Rakia Boyd's death was not captured on video, but St. Hill says the outcome may have been different if cell phone video technology was used. A rash of videos documenting tense police interactions in recent months, including those showing officers assaulting and shooting unarmed individuals, has led to criminal charges in some cases and further outrage against police.
I think in the public's perception now, these are run-of-the-mill incidents. In reality, they are not.
Art Lorigio is a professor of psychology and criminal justice at Loyola University in Chicago.
Note that the police hardly ever pull their guns out of the holster, and the vast majority of police officers are not shooting people. And the overwhelming majority of police officers do not shoot people who die.
But Lorigio says those rare incidents that do involve officer-involved shooting deaths greatly influence public perception against law enforcement.
We react viscerally to those images, and you can see that they're emotionally laden. And so people are going to be more inclined to pay attention to that than to statistics.
We try to tell police officers that they should behave as if they're on camera all the time.
Dean Angelo is a veteran of the Chicago Police Department, who is now president of Chicago's Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge 7. His father was also a police officer, and Angelo's son now wears a badge fighting crime in a very different atmosphere.
It's an accusatory finger that's being pointed at the entire population of law enforcement, and it's a little disturbing.
But Angelo says the cameras aren't going away. In fact, the Chicago Police Department began testing body cameras on some officers earlier this year.
I'm not welcoming cameras for my members. It's my personal spin. But I think that it's going to be good for some of our officers to have those cameras on them.
But for protester Todd St. Hill, the answer isn't more cameras.
The police have never done anything to make me feel safe and have never operated in a way to make me, my family, or my friends feel safe. So for me, the solution is no police in my communities.
Kane Farabaugh reporting from Chicago. Thanks for joining us today on International Edition. Get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Leaders in Africa and beyond have been sorely tested by an Ebola epidemic that raged through areas in West Africa over the last year and claimed more than 10,600 lives. Thanks to an unprecedented international response, the number of new infections has fallen dramatically. But the crisis isn't over. There's still much to do to bring the epidemic to an end, and even more work is needed to prevent a new outbreak. The United States has helped greatly in combating the epidemic since it was identified a year ago. In September, President Obama brought new urgency to the response with speeches and outreach at the United Nations and set an example for the international community with an expanded U.S. response by deploying U.S. troops to build treatment centers and help train health workers. The African Union has been a major partner in this endeavor. Medical personnel deployed by the AU have been critical to the response. Now, an agreement between the AU and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, will establish an African Center for Disease Control and Prevention. We will work together to improve all of Africa's capacity to prevent, detect, and respond to infectious disease threats. The new center's aim is to strengthen the capacities of African nations to understand disease threats, share information about them, and combat not only Ebola, but also HIV, tuberculosis, malaria, and other diseases. Operations are expected to begin later this year with the opening of a surveillance and response unit that will provide technical expertise to African health ministries and help coordinate response to health emergencies. The U.S. CDC will send two public health experts to the new African CDC to serve as technical advisors. We will also support fellowships for 10 African epidemiologists to help staff 5 regional African CDC coordinating centers that will help monitor infectious disease on the continent. We have greatly slowed Ebola's spread, and if the response is sustained, we expect to end the epidemic in a matter of months. Lessons learned here will help African nations prevent future outbreaks and deal with other diseases, too. But the U.S. needs to continue its involvement as well.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.